The first couple of poems I read are set in southern Italy, in a small village called Vietri sul Mare, which is in the Amalfi Coast. It's a traditional fishing village, though its catering industry is a lot more prosperous. And, well, I'll talk about that perhaps later, not on the tourist board. This one's called Sign Language. The deaf-mute fisherman sits in his beach boat with a net he's mending looped round both big toes and his left-hand thumb while his right hand weaves in and out. Air and water crash in soundless waves through the spaces where his livelihood will catch. The fishes whose new names I'm slowly learning, Merluzzo, Alici, Dentici, Pesce Spada. Seeing me reading, he signs that books are better. What he earns in a day, I spend in an hour eating fish at the restaurant he supplies. Motorini swarm in from the cities of the plain, from the little badlands under the shadow of Vesuvius. Then, when the bars are closed, the cars in the car park rock like boats, their windows taped with Lo Sport or L'Unità, and I see him picking his way home through the refuse of a beach culture, with nothing but a bemused, welcoming smile. That when he stops outside his door, I swear he's talking to himself with his fluent hands. I had an idea, kind of compiling a whole group of characters from the village, not a very good idea, but two of them have survived. If that first one was about language, the second one is also about language, but somebody who's more radically marginalized. It's called Il Capitano. He keeps a dark shed by the beach huts and boathouses, smelling of diesel and damp wool. There's a yellow notice tacked to the door in a strange hand or a strange tongue like the babble of waves on pebbles, cursives of broken shell. Bound in his nets and tackle, he carries a trident to tap the ground in the tireless pacing that keeps him always in sight of the sea, where the spiny rocks sift back the waves like krillless drizzle from the teeth of whales. The villagers tell how once, years back, he commanded a vessel wrecked miles out and drifted days on a fragment of deck. Ever since his rescue, he's lived like the last man alive in this coast resort, buzzing with tourists and vespers. He was washed up here like the rest of us, by seed, tide, trade, or fate, but clearly lives, oblivious of custom, under a different sky. The stars urgent and legible, the miles of black salt crashing into coves, his intimate blueprint. It's said that sometimes he sights a ship far out in the blue and foams with an exquisite panic of recognition. Dropping his stick, he thrashes through the waves like a fierce child till the fishermen gently drag him back again. This next poem is also set in the same place, but it's not really about people there. It's actually about Chernobyl, in a sense. It's called Ill Wind, and the ill wind refers to the deposits of radiation that hit southern Italy quite badly. It also makes reference to the Sirocco, which is a wind that blows from the southeast quarter, and it's a hot, asphyxiating wind, but infinitely preferable in the circumstances. Ill Wind. To talk of the weather was a morbid sign. The winds blew wherever they wanted to, raining their freight of dust. A week before, the Sirocco had come with its tiny pouches of sand, transplanting one grain at a time the whole Sahara, silting the windows with a fine tan. But this was a wind from the north that blew across frontiers, ignoring the customs. If it blew somewhere else, the papers were glad. I brushed a spider from the web it had spun between my arm and what seemed to be air. It fell by a thread, then hobbled off its fifth or its sixth leg, giving it trouble. Will they survive it all, you ask, the insects? I remember the mutation rates we'd studied of the fruit fly, short, long, and crossed-winged, and a luminous dream I'd had of origin, life spiraling out from the cradle cell through the basking oceanic forms. And though the leaves were still, I heard the wind snicking the links with its casual shears. A friend from what used to be East Germany told me about this word, Erdmöbel, if I can impose my pronunciation on it. It means earth furniture, and in East Germany at the time he was saying there were these kind of stores which sold funeral goods, and I was quite taken by the idea, really. It seemed to me like kind of high-tech tubular furniture in an Etruscan tomb or something like that. Anyway, I've called it Earth Furniture and the Maiden, but I did it in German, though I don't know it. Erdmöbel und das Mädchen. We export our designs to the other world and expect little in return. In East Germany, the whole range of funeral accessories are sold under the sign Earth Furniture. Cleanliness is close to us. Our rich, dust-free bodies are stored away where the moth's jaws will never reach, and rust and rot will not corrupt. Everywhere you go, you take your glossy furniture catalogue, some cut-price Swedish firm with its nearest depot in Heidelberg. The problem is transportation. You imagine a convoy of lorries crossing the Alps in solemn formation, measuring the length of Italy to darken the road outside your door. Skip that one. For a spurious link, this one is more about the funereal effect of some rented accommodation. It's called Living in Sin. We were never at home in that house, the home of the Bishop of Truro's widow. Our personalities were too small. Our words seemed to tail off, and to touch was a day's journey across the flowered divan. When friends came to stay, we put on a brave face, took meals off the oak table, and walked around as if we owned the place. Even our books were outnumbered and outflanked by their leather-bound tomes. I felt evil, as a water spider in an air bubble, leafing through the annotated Bible. Yet I began to understand his recreations, mainly Daniel and Revelations. The seven hills of Babylon meant Rome, and once there he went to town on scarlet and fornication, lulling himself with wrath. 666 would ring a bell at the Pope's bedside. Or was it upside down, I wondered, implicating the police? Much of it was illegible, but that spiky hand reached out of the grave with its NBs and admonitory rapping commentaries, as the Victorian engravings on the stairs we wanted to, but never dared, remove, had bodies in chaste nightgowns rising from a host of cracked asunder sepulchres, lock-jawed, stiff-jointed, and justified. We were thieves that had stolen into the fold, waiting to be discovered and expelled by a flaming sword. The widow's letter came more terrible than flames, more tearful, at what I don't think we had meant to hide our situation. It was clear she saw the unclean coupling in the inner sanctum, animal appetite under her roof. If only what we'd done had given proof to her acrobatic fantasy. If only the empty rooms had echoed with our cries, we might have felt less wronged. At the year's end, we were given notice, and her middle-aged son, squinting at us with unspeakable pleasure, said he was sorry, but they decided to sell. He helped me shift the tea chest, and his eyes fell on your clothes as though dazed in a perfumed garden. 2 weeks later, a young married couple with the new tenants, filling the house, making themselves at home. The next poem is the shortest title I've ever managed, and it's called And. But actually, not just And, it's Ampersand, so it's even shorter. A born rebel, at ease in your outrage, you refused the armchair's invitation to slump in a heap or sleep in a hump. I'm by contrast on a hardback chair, sitting prim and tight-assed as Britannia, with a shield of books and a chewed biro. The argument we're having is unravelling. The ends that look so odd now, they're asunder. We can only wonder how they ever did get joined together. It seems we've unwound an ampersand and pulled it like a cracker. On the third chair, the black and white cat and the white and black, love locked in a tricky double helix, keep licking each other's necks. This next poem is slightly longer, is a poem I think I ought to say that it's set in Salerno, which is a town in southern Italy near, well, in the Neapolitan region. And I used to see at the docks these logs of hardwoods that would be beside the Fiats to be exported. They'd come from Africa, I think. And they would be transported just a short way along the road to, I mean, half a mile down the road where they'd stay the night. I mean, I could never understand, you know, why they just didn't stay the night where they were before. But anyway, that's where it starts from. I think also I ought to say that Axle Tree is the title, and it refers a little bit to those myths of an axis which joins heaven to earth. Often like Yggdrasil, a tree, or kind of Axis Mundi, something connecting it. Axle Tree. I lurk like a stowaway in the dark threshold of your block of flats and wait for a sign. I park my wreck beside the lorries that slouch at the curb till dawn, laden to the tusks with mahogany logs from Senegal. At the docks, just a caver's toss away, where row after row of raw pink Fiats are waiting for legion to possess them. They season in heaps, and no sooner move than come to a halt, as if obeying some natural imperative. Your balcony gives on timber seeping resin in the moonlight, the mountains bracketing the bay's black waves as they fret on the seafront, and the frail hull of the unfrequented nave ristorante, moored under the cement factory's toxic plume. It's all crammed in like a tourist map, night shifts, headlamps, and the desultory tide, the palm fronds shrugging on the promenade. Loosed from the shaggy leggings of those logs, I expect a windfall of tree snakes and insects to seep through the holes in my peeled-back roof. Only last week, a scorpion stung you. Starting as a fire on the side of your thigh, it came to a head in a charred violet point. You became irascible and superstitious and dreamed of a horrible martyrdom. You felt my star sign made me somehow to blame, as if I'd hired a familiar for the crime. My car fell under suspicion. You began to call it the touring insect house, checking the seats and shadows on entering, where before you'd merely likened it to the bin skips with their beds of decomposing ash-blue mulch. I've my doubts, too. Do lovers use it by night? Its suspension is not what it used to be. Beer bottles, cigarette packets with odd brand names, chewed gum wads, all add up to something. Nocturnal depredations. Anything could live there, biodegrading, unobserved, while the rear mirror makes headlights flare like stars snapped out of fixity, and the hewn trunks seem lengths of a broken axle, around which once the leaf-green planet turned. This poem is called Odradek, Odradek 2, actually. Now, Odradek makes his first appearance in a story by Kafka called Troubles of a Householder. So it's a bit presumptuous to steal it in the spirit of kind of Rocky 1, 2, etc. But in Kafka's story, Odradek is a figure who's kind of aimless and harmless and utterly inscrutable, well, at least to me. And it means in Czech, apparently, it's in the penguin, it's underneath, it means beyond the law. He's transformed himself or herself since. I'm trying to deal with a kind of spirit of meaninglessness, the kind of thing that does to the mind what viruses do to computers. You saw the letters fall on the floor. It's like that. Odradek 2. It is hard to describe me, and why should I try? When the cleaners have gone home, I trek through the rubber-tread corridors, rolling on my faces like a marble ashtray. I sprout cilia or a pseudopodium, fed on burn bags and administrative boredom. Everything stale, glazed, exhaled, used up, left over, sustains me. I grow star-shaped and lucid like a cog at the core of the system. Suavely, I propagate in the tepid pipes and filters of the air conditioning. I breathe the greasy dust of the lift shaft, dating its bouquet with my carbon palate, and feel the shadow of the iron weight plumb through the floors on its frayed cable as the bare bulb rises like a yellow eye. Moiling in the dark of utility, I'm attuned to the subtle traffic of the air. You will not be rid of me. I become computer adept and user friendly. My image flickers and your days are numbered. This poem, there was some about transport in the other one. This is a different form of transportation, a slightly clumsy one with a bucket and a balloon. One thing I refer to in the beginning of the poem is this kind of aerial photography, which began with Nader's photographs of Paris. I don't think any of them, maybe they're daguerreotypes, but none of them have survived. But clearly afterwards, aerial photography is much more useful for espionage or warfare or whatever. This is a short history of aerial photography. Some of the local place names are in Liverpool. The India Buildings, the Pierhead, Garston. And Pilkington's, as you probably know, is the glass factory, which is one of the more robust industries in Liverpool at the moment. It's called Landing. I travelled in a bucket strapped below a vast balloon like an eyeball, over the roofs of Paris, taking photographs, and over alleys narrow as the makeshift coffins the communards lay in with numbered tags around their necks, till the wind blew me, clattering northwards past the gunboats and the crowds on the quayside waving flags. Then in a cold, dark, haywire cloud of rain, I saw the India Buildings and the pierhead and followed the river widening to Garston. Between the listing buoys and sandbanks, two mulish tugs were pulling a tanker loaded with glass from Pilkington's. On the far shore, the sky at Port Sunlight was singed by a petrol flame, while the near green railings on the riverbank were matted black from the high tide's oil clods. I saw a man bent by work so double, his face looked at his navel where he held a mirror to show him the road ahead. I could taste iron in the air or naphthalene. Either the rocks were bleeding or the horizon was on fire. This is the stain of empire, said one sign with a skull above a knife and fork. Another claimed in a script of faded gold, everything that has been will be restored. A third one merely pointed to the playground where the docks used to be. Now couples raced in coal trucks round the wasteland railway. Then I landed like a silk bomb by the glass house and opened the chipped door onto daylight, smashing light off every kindled edge and curve. Lace like ferns and forests with man-sized leaves grew round the aisles where everybody was, wild in the humming lattice of the dome. The next one is called Nostalgia, which is sort of like nostalgia, but more homesickness. Just to gloss it, the room of the Sirocco, which is mentioned in it, taken for the title of the book, refers to a room in Sicilian palazzi, which of the more opulent sort, where people can retire from the Sirocco wind. It's obviously a rather privileged room to have. Nostalgia. I woke drenched in sweat and homesick, for nowhere I could think of, a feeling scuffed and quaint as farthings or furlongs. Then I remembered the room of the Sirocco in a Sicilian palace made of pink volcanic sugar. There was a scent of waxed oak and pistachios. Two maids were making up our nuptial bed, smoothing the white linen with their dark hands. You'd never have finished finding fault in their work if I hadn't intervened, so that you turned on me, saying, their family were turnip doctors at the time of the Bourbons. An old enmity then, and more imperious even than pleasure. How to get out of that windowless room with not one of its walls adjoining the air was all I could think of from that point on. Your voice pursued me down the marble stairway. Don't think you'll ever find a home again. That's that. How am I doing for time? Just one more. Oh, we've got one. It's a long one. Yeah. This goes back to this village in southern Italy that I started with. I mentioned that the fishing and the catering were the two trades, but there is another one, which is ceramics, which is quite historically grounded there too, and very beautiful pottery. One thing that's slightly interesting about it is that the village is separated from the mainland by a seam of clay which has supplied the pottery, but it also made it sort of untouched by the earthquake that 7 or 8 years ago hit southern Italy very badly, and even a mile or so down the coast was quite badly damaged by that. It is more vulnerable, as I mentioned at the end of the poem, to flooding, sea storms, really. It's called Mermaid. My mistake was not to leave a breathing space, a vacuole for firing in the kiln, but I was only thinking of the shape she'd grow into, sleek and seal grey, her flanks busted with a patina of sea slime. She did not look like something that could last, washed up, drying from the outside inwards, a shade more pallid every day. But the limbs I was lucky with, the arch of the back, the balance of her small, provocative head, and the breasts on which I'd lavished more than a cameo maker's care. The tail was cleftless with the usual scales etched by a pin. So how did mermaids mate? No doubt they found some way, agonizingly metamorphic for their cast-ashore princes, though I strayed no nearer solution than the faintest hint. On that coastal windowsill, she sat battening on the muzzle crash the waves made on the rocks, draining in tiny rills. When she broke across the navel, in a break so fine she could still balance without glue on those stunning ichthyan hips. The second crack came in an argument at the curve where her knees would have been. There was a storm, and the sea crashed against the mole. Then, when we moved to make way for the rich summer tenants, among boxes of stones and shells, the beachcomb chips off sea-worn tiles, she took more punishment. Her nose crumbled, and her face became the fate of Crusade in the dry point version of Henryson. She stayed among discarded things stacked in the back of my battered citron, its scalloped bonnet like the boat of Venus, until the day the sea storm peeled the roofs from the beach huts and a great wave pulled the piazza with salt water, waist-deep where the cars were parked. There, in the boot, I found a layer of sand and nothing more than a grey trace, a silt of potter's clay. Thank you.